Hello, welcome to the Eating for Health podcast. I'm Dr. Harriet Holm, founder of Healthy Eating Doctor, registered nutritionist and doctor. I studied medicine at Cambridge University, worked in the NHS for over a decade, have a PhD in genetics, lecture on nutrition, and was commissioned to write a novel degree combining culinary skills, nutrition and health. I'm on a mission to break down nutrition myths and share science-backed nutrition to help empower you. I'll share some interviews, theories and practical tips focused around nutrition and health. Stay tuned to find out more. As a huge fan of Bake Off, I'm really delighted to have Kimberly Wilson, Bake Off finalist, on to talk with me today. More importantly, though, Kimberly is a chartered psychologist and author of How to Build a Healthy Brain, working in private practice in central London. She's a governor of the Tavistock and Portman NHS Mental Health Trust and led the therapy service at Holloway Prison for a decade, which at the time was Europe's largest women's prison. Kimberly believes the way we think about mental health as separate from physical health is flawed. Her philosophy of whole body mental health is a comprehensive approach to mental health care, integrating evidence-based nutrition and lifestyle factors with psychological therapy. Her degree in nutrition informs her approach of looking at the roles of food and lifestyle play in our mental health, including disordered eating, gut-brain axis, and our emotional relationship with food. If you'd like to hear more from Kimberly, she also co-hosts the podcast Made of Stronger Stuff alongside Dr. Zand van Tulleken on BBC Radio 4. So I'm really delighted to welcome Kimberly Wilson onto my podcast, and you probably know her from Bake Off, but she's had an incredibly varied career, which covers psychology, even prisons, nutrition, and I'm really excited to talk to her and pick her brains about brain health and ask her about her book. So firstly, if you could just sort of tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll dive into the questions.
Sure. I mean, you've pretty much covered it. So I am a chartered psychologist. I work one-on-one with people, but I also have a master's degree in nutrition. And in that degree, I focused on essentially the role of nutrition in neurodegeneration and brain aging and what evidence we have that nutrition can affect the way that our brains develop, age, and also whether we can use nutrition to improve mental health outcomes. And so now much of my work really sits there. A little bit of science communication, so getting this information out to the public in various ways, including this podcast, as well as working with people around their relationships with food, how they approach eating and what food means to them.
So when you see a client then, do you have a more holistic approach? It's not just focused on the psychology, but are you also sort of saying about their diet as well? And how do you manage your practice?
Absolutely. Because from my perspective, you cannot separate the mind from the body. The brain is an organ. It's embodied in the body. Everything it understands about the world is actually through your senses, is through your body. So it doesn't make any sense for us, even in terms of how the brain changes. Because one of the things we want to do in therapy is to help people build new neural pathways, you know, new habits, new perspectives, new ways of seeing the world. And that's literally your brain changing shape and connections. In order to do that, it needs to be properly nourished and well slept. It needs to be in a good physiological state for you to even get the benefits of therapy. So it doesn't make sense for me to be trying to, you know, help someone with their depression if actually they're sleeping only 3 hours a night and they're eating terribly and they're not really moving their bodies very much, because their brains will not be in the state it needs to be in to get the best outcomes from therapy. So yes, I work when people come to see me, I always warn people. I say I do a very comprehensive assessment, and my assessment involves understanding, you know, I get them to give me a sleep diary, a food diary, some of their medical history, some of their history of eating and movement, you know, questions about their job. So I get all of that in advance. And then we also do what would be considered the standard therapy assessment, which is usually conducted over 2 to 4 sessions. So it's very comprehensive. And then I put all of that together. We sit again for another session and say, and I say, well, this is how I think your physiology might be impacting how you feel. This is how I think some of your psychology might be impacting how you feel. And this is how I would work with you on it, you know, because people are very welcome to then just take the assessment. And if they only want to work on something else, find someone who will do that for them, because, you know, it's an undertaking. But this is how I would want to work with you on it. Are you happy to go ahead? And then we make the agreement.
Well, it sounds a really positive way of doing it. But what, so for me, as you know, as I was a doctor previously, but when I did my psychiatry jobs and early rotations as a junior doctor, it felt like there was a huge divide. And you sort of touched on it already, that people really seem to think that mental health and physical health are different. And even, you know, the nurses are very different. Often the hospital or the wards are located in a different place. It's a very different style of medicine. And I think from my experience, you know, okay, it was 15 years ago, but it felt very much less evidence-based than the rest of medicine. It feels like lots of it's still really poorly understood. The sort of the treatments, the mechanisms are poorly understood for a lot of psychiatric conditions. And I wonder if it's partly historical, but, you know, even sort of now in the 21st century, with even a lot more awareness about the importance of mental health, just the, probably the way research is funded, other diseases like cancer probably get more of a, you know, the share of charitable funds, and there's probably a lot more research and more biomarker driven research. So why do you think there's, why do you think it's treated so differently?
Well, so I think there are lots of contributing factors, and you really talk about one of the, you touched on the one of the vicious cycle elements of it, which is because we have this kind of shrug your shoulders, your hands to the sky approaches to mental health, it does get a fraction of the research funding of other what we'd consider physical illnesses. So, for example, dementia has the highest social care costs of almost any disease. It's, you know, it takes a long time to develop. People, the average life expectancy after diagnosis about 6 years. It means that people are less able to care for themselves. And so there are huge kind of social care costs and burdens, but it gets less funding than cancer or heart disease, diabetes. And so we know less about it, and therefore we feel more hopeless about it, and therefore we don't invest in it. And it, you know, it goes round and round in this kind of terrible cycle where it's one of these also ran disorders that we just ignore. And because of that, people think, the public thinks that there's very little that you can do about it. So if you ask most people on the street, something like 80% of people will say, oh yeah, I think there's something that I can do about my risks of heart disease. I think, you know, I believe there's something that I can do about my risks of diabetes. But very few people, less than a quarter of people, believe that there is anything they can do about their risk of Alzheimer's disease or their risk of depression. And that contravenes actually what we know very well in the evidence. And even with something like Alzheimer's disease, which is the illness that most the adults are most afraid of, you know, 50% of people say, I'm most afraid of Alzheimer's disease and dementia. But the latest Lancet Commission says, actually, if we shift lifestyle, if we help people understand the modifiable risk factors, so the things that you can modify in your lifestyle, we could delay or prevent 40% of global Alzheimer's disease,
which is diagnosis. Absolutely staggering, really, isn't it? I mean, and the cost, the quality of life, you know, the impact on people's, not just the person with Alzheimer's, but, you know, all of that circle of that family around them. I mean, it's astonishing, really, isn't it?
Absolutely astonishing. So this disease that so many people feel A, terrified of, and then B, hopeless about, is actually one where there's a huge amount that we can do. No, there's no silver magic bullets. We're not going to make any promises that you can definitely stave it off. And of course, some people who do have pristine lifestyles will just be unlucky. But this big group of people who are at risk, and sometimes even people who already have early signs of disease, through modification of lifestyle behaviors, can slow the halt progression, disease progression, slow brain atrophy, and sometimes perhaps even delay when they might have a diagnosis, giving them more years of good life with their families, in their jobs, with their children, whatever it is. And people really need to know that.
No, and we're going to talk, I'm going to ask you more about that in a minute. But I also wonder as well, if we sort of think a lot of the time it's sort of a natural aging process, and that it's not in the same way like a cancer where it's sort of an abnormal growth and you want to, you know, cut it out, and it's sort of a, more of a disease, or people with it that are young highlight the tragic nature of it, that it's just as awful if you're getting Alzheimer's, and there are so many people that we could, you know, prevent and such a sort of huge impact. So tell us more then, if we want to stave off Alzheimer's, and how can we protect our brain? How can we look after it long term?
So there are 12 modifiable risk factors. I won't go through them all because we only have a short amount of time. But the ones, I guess the biggest bangs for your bucks are going to be, I think the big, I will call them the big four. So we're talking sleep, nutrition, exercise, and social engagement. And education, let's call it the big five. So we know, for example, that sleep disorders are one of the big risk factors, the big associations that we see is people who have maybe years and years and years of insomnia have a higher risk factor of dementia and cognitive decline. There's some questions as to, you know, which way round is it? Is it chicken and egg? Is it that early disease makes it more difficult for your brain to generate good sleep? Or is it that poor sleep contributes to disease progression? But what we do know is that the accumulation of a toxic protein in Alzheimer's disease, which is called amyloid beta or beta amyloid, amyloid for short. So it builds up, it's part of the normal metabolic waste, just junk that your brain produces in its everyday business, because your brain is very, very metabolically active. It's always churning, always going. It's a factory where there's always a shift. People are coming in all times of day and night. And this protein builds up. And when it builds up, if it doesn't get cleared away, it can block the communication between your nerve cells. And if you block the communication in your nerve cells for long enough, those nerves die away. Your brain says, well, there's no point in maintaining these nerves. We're not using them. There's no signals coming through. So we might as well just let them degrade. And so clearance of amyloid is understood at the moment, at least, to be one of the good candidate for reducing Alzheimer's disease risk. And your clearance of amyloid, your brain's natural clearance of amyloid, is doubled during deep sleep. So it happens during the day, but it's doubled during deep sleep. So, and what's extraordinary is in animal studies, they've shown that your cells, your nerve cells pull apart and cerebral spinal fluid, almost like this kind of liquid, comes through the brain to clear it out. So it's a really important kind of maintenance mechanism for your brain. So making sure you're taking care of your sleep is really important. Addressing sleep issues as early as possible, not trying to tough it out, not trying to pretend that you can get by on 4 hours sleep like some sort of monster. Just.
But though, I have to say, so as a mother of two young children, I find that a sleep a hugely worrying thing. So, and also, you know, most of my, I mean, since probably the last 15, 20 years until I left medicine, I was doing shift patterns, a full shift rota. So I had years of very disrupted sleep, trying to sleep in the day, up all night. I remember my intensive care rota, we did 4 long days on, so 4 14 days on, 4 nights, and then 2 days off, and then we rotated. So, and I'm sure there are lots of other doctors and nurses and lorry drivers and everyone else on a shift pattern. And I know there's, for example, like a link with melatonin secretion, which is your sleepy hormone, the hormone you secrete at night to signal to go to sleep, and things like breast cancer. So I imagine that the same there with things like Alzheimer's. But how do you, whether it's your career or whether it's your young children waking you up, how do you know what is good enough sleep? And because is it sort of like the myth of drinking 8 glasses of water where actually you just need to drink for thirst? What actually does good sleep look like, and how do we achieve it when sometimes it's completely out of my control whether I get a good night's sleep?
Sure. Yeah, and that's why I say kind of long periods of very chronic sleep deprivation or insomnia, because of course there are periods of our lives where, as you say, it's very, very difficult. I think, you know, on a slight tangent, that medicine really needs to overhaul its shift patterns. There's no real reason why it has to still continue the way it does in this kind of hazing where at least junior doctors are put on absolutely ridiculous shift cycles. I think if medicine got its act together and sat down and thought about best ways of keeping doctors safe, because one of the big things around doctors' mental health is the risk of depression, burnout, and the number of GPs, for example, who are kind of just hemorrhaging from the National Health Service. And that's going to be about working practices. So we need to think more carefully about how we keep our doctors safe and protect them and make it.
Absolutely. I think one of the challenges with that is that people are sick 24/7,
sure,
and with a staff shortage, you've got to find, you know, cover it. And I think there are huge holes and lots of rotas and gaps, and I think that's a real challenge for the employers and the employees. But yeah, I can't see that changing anytime soon, sadly.
Yeah, no, but because I was asked a question, sorry, at real tangent, but I was asked a question, someone was saying, oh, maybe we should be able to give doctors kind of stimulant drugs to help them stay alert on night shifts. And I thought, if it's that bad that you're thinking about drugging wow. doctors, something is really broken in this system.
It is, but I think there is, to be perfectly honest, there's quite a lot broken in the system. For example, it's changed in recent years in that it used to be on call overnight and there were on call rooms. So if there was a period where it was a bit quieter, you could go and have a sleep and have a rest. And I think for a lot of people that really recharged their batteries. And I know that if I had a sick child, I'd far rather a doctor who'd had a 20-minute break and had a lie down than one that was doing discharge summaries or admin. And certainly in a number of hospitals that I worked, if you were caught having a nap in a, so there are no on-call rooms anymore, but if you were caught having a 10-minute nap at 4 o'clock in the morning in a chair in a staff room, they actually did, they got the cleaners to photograph and name and shame you in the hospital newsletter. So there's a long way to go within the NHS culture. So I think a lot needs to feed through that actually break reporting, exception reporting. I hope that things will eventually change, but I think, sadly, it's a long way off.
Yeah, much to do. But for your listeners, yes, I think you're right. In the same way that 8 glasses of water is a little bit of a myth, 8 hours for everyone is a bit of a myth. And so we know that there are people who are what we call slightly shorter sleepers, so short sleepers, which is around 6-7 hours. And then there are long sleepers, so kind of 7-9 hour people. That is likely to be genetically driven. There's not really much you can do to shift your sleep need. And the best way to assess whether you're a shorter or a longer sleeper is literally to sleep. So you take, let's say you take 3 or 4 days when you don't have any work commitments, and you go to bed when you start to feel tired. And then you allow yourself to wake up without an alarm. And, you know, how many hours was that for you to feel rested?
Okay.
So not when you've got a big sleep debt. So not if you've kind of come off several late shifts and, oh, actually, I need 15 hours of sleep to recover.
I think I've done that since I was a teenager. And I think I feel I could sleep for a week and it wouldn't be enough. But, you know.
So if you're like, oh, I don't get sleepy until actually about 11 o'clock, so maybe you're a bit of a natural night owl as well, and then I like to wake up around 7, well, then you're probably somewhere around a 7.5-8 hour sleeper, and that's your number. And then where possible, it's for you to try to augment your life to help you get those number of hours as consistently as possible. And so similarly, again, and this becomes very difficult in terms of how society is set up, but trying to arrange your life to fit your normal chronobiology, whether you're a night owl or a lark, if you like to be up early, then try to do that. If you know your brain's not really functioning that early in the morning, then seeing what you can do, whether you can talk to your employee and say, look, can I start an hour later and I'll work an hour later, you'll get more out of me because my brain will function better. Like, I don't we started at 10 o'clock, my brain doesn't really get going until about now, and so I do that on purpose so that I don't sound like an absolute fool on podcasts, because I know that just my chronotype, my brain won't be alive until about now.
No, fair enough. Mine also is probably the same, but sadly I've been up, done the school run and done all the rest of it on a non-functioning brain. But yes, and I'm a light, you know, a night owl up till all hours. But yes, I think it's difficult. Obviously, there are lots of factors that just are not under your control.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. So where possible, and that's always the caveat, wherever you can. And of course, if you need a nap in the afternoon, have a nap, that's fine. Somewhere around an hour is not a problem. If you find you have a lot of daytime sleepiness, and that's sometimes a cause for concern, but a little nap in the afternoon, I think, is an absolute luxury if you can get it. And then trying to keep a consistent sleep pattern across the weekend as well. Again, lots of people will want to catch up on sleep, and if you need to, then do, but where possible, try to keep a nice consistent pattern across the week. Your brain doesn't know it's Saturday or Sunday. Your brain likes routine, so it likes things to be consistent every day.
Okay, great. I think I'm going to come and swap lives with you, Kimberly, and I get my 8 hours my daytime now.
Like a lion, as I'm just lying asleep.
So tell me about exercise. How does exercise impact brain health?
Exercise is perhaps the most robust set of research evidence that we have for the protective influence of a lifestyle factor on brain health. And it does it through lots of different mechanisms. And in my book, I kind of go through, I quickly kind of scope through, because other, again, you could do a whole book on it, and some people have. But broadly, I guess two main things to think about. So your brain, as I said, is incredibly metabolically active. You know, 20%, a quarter of all of your energy needs when your body is at rest is for your brain. So you and I sitting here, for every 4 or 5 calories that our entire bodies are using, one or two of those are for our brain. So constantly churning away, constantly using up, you know, a big chunk of your energy needs. And in order to supply those demands, your brain needs a very good blood supply. So, you know, there are pints and pints of blood flowing through your brain every second, bringing nutrients, energy in the form of glucose and oxygen in order to fuel metabolism. So aerobic exercise is one of the ways, you know, in the same way that you use it to keep your heart healthy and keep your blood vessels nice and flexible and keep your blood pressure in a healthy level, the same goes for your brain. So when you are exercising vigorously, somewhere between 20 minutes and 30 minutes, 3 times a week, then you're keeping that blood flow up, you're keeping those blood vessels nice and flexible, you're making sure that even those cells right at the front of your brain have a good supply of all the nutrients and oxygen it needs to function well. So aerobic exercise is very good for that. But also resistance exercise, and particularly for women, and I always want to highlight this because although, you know, pretty much everyone is really worried about Alzheimer's disease, women have twice the risk of dementia and Alzheimer's disease as men, and particularly post-menopause. And one of the worries is that there's a real relationship between physical strength, like muscular strength, and protection from Alzheimer's disease. So in studies where they've taken two groups of older women and have one group do stretching exercises 3 times a week and one group do resistance exercises, so push-ups and pull-ups, maybe doing some light weight training 2 or 3 times a week. In the weight training group, when you scan their brains, they have healthier brains, so fewer lesions in their brains, slower brain aging. And one of the reasons for that is that the same chemicals that are released into your bloodstream when you lift weights that make your muscles grow, so are growth factors, cross into the brain and support the protection of your brain cells as well. So when you're lifting weights, you're literally strengthening your brain at the same time. And that's really important because as women get older, we tend to do less resistance exercise. We, you know, women compared to men do less resistance exercise anyway, always worried about getting bulky and all of this nonsense. Where actually women lifting weights, A, protects them from frailty and falls and things, sarcopenia as they get older, but also is one of a really important way of protecting their brain health, which is absolutely crucial for everyone, but particularly women who have this higher risk.
And I think it's really interesting there that you've highlighted the connection between, you know, physical strength and mental function. Mm. It's quite remarkable because there's that study where they stressed people out by giving them really complicated arithmetic and then looked at their grip strength. And remarkably, the more stressed you feel, the less you can grip something. So, I mean, it's quite remarkable. I think, you know, going back to what we started the conversation with about how people really like to separate the mental and physical health, it is such a sort of, you know, really does work together.
Your body doesn't know that we consider your brain separate from the rest of it. Like, your body has no idea that we do that in a kind of cultural, social sense. Yeah. And your body speaks one language of stress. You know, your brain-body complex doesn't separate emotional stress from work stress from your body just says, well, I'm feeling another layer of stress, and it all affects your entire physiology. And so, and we call, and the impact of, say, one system on another, so the way lifting weights will protect your brain, is cross adaptation. So you can improve one area and it will have knock-on benefits for another. And yeah, so physical activity, as well as all, you know, the plethora of other ways that physical activity is really important for you, it is absolutely crucial for your brain health.
And lots of people sort of think that brain health increases the serotonin, the happy hormone. Mm-hmm. How does that link in with it all then?
So serotonin is an interesting one because it's moved into the kind of everyday language, and people are, you know, there are memes about serotonin and what we should be doing to boost our serotonin. There's this idea that more is better. That's not necessarily the case. And actually, it's whilst, this is such a complicated story. So serotonin is involved in mood, but actually most scientists aren't entirely sure exactly how, what the mechanisms are, and there are probably a few of them. One of the things that's important to note is that serotonin is, of course, produced from nutrients. So as well as tryptophan, which is one that people are very aware of, and they always think, well, if I need to have more serotonin, should I take tryptophan supplements, and will that make me feel better? Whilst it's, yes, tryptophan is one of those, an amino acid that comes from protein foods, actually serotonin synthesis requires other micronutrients. It requires iron, vitamin C, vitamin B12, you know, so you need to have a good complement of micronutrients in order to synthesize it anyway. But the most limiting factor on your serotonin production is actually stress. So when you feel stressed and you get, your body turns on your cytokine production, so those proteins that trigger inflammation, that are triggered by inflammation and lead this big cascade in your immune system. What that can do, very briefly, is to take away tryptophan, so that amino acid that makes serotonin, takes tryptophan away from that pathway, that metabolic pathway, and sends it towards another. It sends it towards one called kynurenine, which makes quinolinic acid, which can be neurotoxic. So actually stress and chronic stress is one, and it makes sense that that's one of the biggest factors that impacts our mood, because then you're literally reducing the availability of tryptophan in your of serotonin in your body, because there's less tryptophan availability. So more than eating turkey or bananas or oats or anything like that, probably the best thing that you can do if you're thinking, how do I improve my mood, is to really assess your chronic stress and the stress that your body, your entire body, is under from whatever is happening in your life, and doing what you can, getting the support that you can from friends, family, other services to help you manage that stress. And that's going to help nudge your body into the right kind of physiology to help your brain to recover.
No, that's great. And so I think we've now probably talked about two of your big five then. So
exercise and sleep, nutrition. I would always tell people to focus on the big three, which is polyphenols, fiber, and omega-3 fatty acids. And honestly, the more that I'm reading and talking to researchers about omega-3, in fact, there was a paper published today which was looking at shifting omega-3 fatty acid composition in the body and helping people with bipolar disorder manage their moods, ADHD, certainly depression, and neurodegeneration. There's very good evidence that omega-3 fatty acids, which you get from oily fish, salmon, trout, mackerel, anchovies, that sort of thing, in combination with B vitamins and other micronutrients, literally slow the progression of brain aging. That's really important, because these fats your body can't produce. You have to get them from your diet to have sufficient amounts. They are a physical kind of building block of your brain cell membranes. You need them to have a healthy brain cell membrane, which is flexible, and so that your brain cells can send signals, which is essentially everything that your brain does is about sending signals. And these fats are essential for that process. What terrifies me is that less than 5% of children are getting an adequate intake of these fats. So these brains, which are still developing, and your brain is still developing until your mid-20s, and then obviously you want to maintain it for the rest of your adult life, less than 5% of children are getting these fats, which are absolutely essential for the structure of a healthy brain. And that's a real worry.
No, I agree entirely. And I think it just highlights the importance that we should all be having oily fish twice a week. If you are vegan, and it is definitely a lot harder to get it from nuts and seeds and plant-based sources, and you should really consider a supplement, and, you know, and really getting those kids to eat two portions of oily fish a week. And the sort of, not just the importance of omega-3 as a membrane, and as you've also, you know, the structure and integrity of the membrane, as you've alluded to, but also as a transmitter for so many other things. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's got huge, wide-ranging effects. It's important for heart health, for bones, for joints, for brain. You know, we all really do need to be eating it. Yeah, and it's great that just by having a bit of oily fish each week, that you could, you know, reduce your risk factor for all these different chronic diseases, which I think is, you know, remarkable, and it's really under, you know, your control. So you've said about oily fish, and then you were just talking about, so polyphenols, which, just to let everybody know, they're antioxidant compounds which you find in fruit and vegetables. And one easy way of sort of thinking about them is that they're the bright colours. Mm. So the brighter, the more brightly coloured fruit and vegetables you have, probably the more polyphenols. And you want to be eating that rainbow to get all those different types of polyphenols in, not just sticking to one apple, but, you know, having lots of different colours. They all have slightly different functions. So eat that rainbow, eat as much variety as possible.
Yeah, and essentially, in terms of the brain, again, lots of different, as you say, lots of different effects, and they are metabolized by the gut microbiome. But in the brain, what they do is to help your blood vessels to relax. They turn on an enzyme that turns on a chemical that helps your blood vessels to relax, which gets more blood into your brain. And so in studies on both children and adults, where you give them a polyphenol rich drink, so a blueberry drink or a blackberry drink or frozen elderberries or whatever, these polyphenol rich foods, which berries are particularly high in them, you get better attention, you get better working memory function, you get improved processing, you get improved outcomes on tests, because the brains are getting more nutrients, more oxygen, metabolizing, they're working faster and more efficiently, and therefore you get better brain function and outcomes on tests. So it's really, really quite an easy hack if you can kind of get on board with eating these brightly colored foods.
And the inflammation levels are also associated with low mood and depression. I think that they've shown as well that if you take an actual a medication producing those effects, so lowering inflammation, that increases your mood. So it's linked with mood. So just sort of another, as we'd say in the research, you know, an orthogonal, another way of confirming that inflammation is so important, and that omega-3, that ratio between omega-3 and omega-6, so you want to have lots more omega-3, which is missing in the Western diet, where we have a lot more omega-6. So a combination of the fruit, the vegetables, the omega-3, and then the fiber, which is so important for your gut health, you know, microbiota.
And there's still so much we don't know, but what we do know so far is, yes, that your gut is really the big fire station in terms of inflammation. So much of your immune system is in and around your gut, which makes sense because that's where most of the dangers are going to be coming in. Most of the things that are going to make you sick, you're likely to take in when you eat, whether it's a bad piece of meat or, you know, some other kind of contamination. So your body prepares and protects you for that by ensuring that you have lots of immune cells in and around your gut. And that's all fine when you eat enough fiber, because then your bacteria eat the fiber. They produce lots of fantastic compounds for you, vitamin K, you know, precursors to your neurotransmitters. Like, they are earning their keep. They're not just squatting. Your microbiome is really working hard for you when you feed it enough fiber. But I guess essentially when you're not, what they do is to turn to an alternative fuel source, which is called mucin. They start to eat that protective gel layer that protects your gut lining. And when that becomes exposed, so if you're not eating enough fiber, when your protective gel layer in your gut is eaten through or degraded, then bacteria can cross into your bloodstream. Your immune cells go, whoa, you guys should not be here. You get this increased immune activity or inflammation, and that's where we get problems. When there's inflammation in the body and where it can potentially cross over into the brain, that's when you're going to have difficulties. And this is why I have my clients tell me what they're eating, so that I have a bit of an assessment on, okay, are you getting, you know, are you supporting your gut microbiome as much as possible? What is happening in this entire system that we could maybe tweak that might just give you a little bit of an improvement without you even having to sit down and tell me all of your life story? Can we give you some very simple tweaks that will just help you? So fiber is one of them. And hardly anyone in the UK is getting the recommended amount of fiber.
No, absolutely. And to get the recommended 30 grams a day of fiber, you really have to think fiber, fiber, fiber at every meal time. And just to say, shortly there will be, it might be there already, or it might be on its way, a fiber, free fiber download checklist, so you can tick it off and work out how much of fiber you're getting. That'll be on my website. And I think absolutely, there's so much more to know about the microbiota. We're literally just scratching the surface. But there's been some really interesting mouse experiments. So they use special germ-free mice. So those are mice that don't have any microbiota, so no bugs on them or inside them. And if you do a fecal transplant from humans with depression, the mice then display behaviours in keeping with depression-like states. Mm-hmm. So the way the gut and the brain, we're going to come on to that in a minute, you know, are linked, is incredible. But it's also incredible how those bugs inside you can modulate your behaviour. Mm-hmm. So as you said about how they ferment that fibre, that those are then actually, as neurotransmitters, they're used as those chemicals actually have a real impact. So we really need to be protecting it, to be enriching it, to be really optimizing our microbiota, not just for our brain and mood, but also cardiovascular disease, obesity, you know, inflammation, autoimmune diseases, as you said about learning about tolerance of your, so self-tolerance, learning what is self and what's evading bacteria. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really fascinating. Have you got any thoughts on sort of probiotics then with?
Well, I mean, there was a really interesting paper by the Sonnenbergs published, I think, a couple of weeks ago, which they compared the increasing the amount of fiber in your diet with increasing the amount of fermented foods in your diet. So these kind of naturally existing probiotic foods. And what they found was, so we all know that fiber is really good in supporting your gut microbiome, but in terms of increasing diversity, it was the fermented foods that really did the job. So your kimchi, your sauerkraut, your kefir,
kombucha,
pasteurized cheeses, you know, your kind of blue cheeses and those sorts of things, sourdoughs.
You know, they are kind of killed off by the cooking process, but yeah, but you know, I guess it's just about
once in some studies, even heating a probiotic drink. So if you took a kefir, for example, and heated it, actually the metabolites that were already there were still having positive effects. So there's potentially some role for the same thing in sourdough breads. And so, yes, there's, in terms of improving your diversity of your gut microbiome, which again, at this early stage, what we seem to know is that having a diverse gut microbiome is associated with better health outcomes, then trying to get some of those live foods in is really important. And I think they've just announced that for the Rome criteria for IBS, so this is something that comes up quite a lot, and IBS mm-hmm. really is almost a quintessential gut brain body brain connection disorder. It's a stress sensitive functional disorder of the gut, and they've just added probiotics as one of the recommended treatment protocols. So still lots to learn. For most people who don't have a gut disorder or haven't been told that you have a gut problem, taking a probiotic supplement probably isn't going to do very much. And they're most likely going to be better off trying to get those live bacteria through foods, so kombuchas and kefirs and so forth.
Absolutely. And also the studies on those bacteria are normally really specific. They're looking for specific outcome measures with very specific strains. So just taking a sort of random one off the shelf or influenza-led, you know, might not actually have any effect or the desired effect. Mm. I'm much more pro improving your diet. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's much more controllable.
I'll be very brief for the last two. So education and brain challenge, essentially your brain is use it or lose it. So what you stop using, the moment you stop learning, your brain stops maintaining those neurons. And what we know, there's a principle called cognitive reserve, which is if you build up, I call it, it's almost like if you're a town planner. So if you think of your brain as a city or a small town, and you've got lots of roads to get to your destination, but let's say a big pothole arrives in the middle of that road. If that's the only way you can get to that destination, that's it, you're gone. So in your brain, if you've only got one way to get to the name of your first pet, if that area is damaged, then you're never remembering that again. But if you can build up lots of different connections, if you put new roads in, new access routes in, then the traffic can divert and you can get to that destination through a different route. And this is what your brain does when you learn. When you learn, you build new connections, you're putting down new roads, you're making new access routes, so that if, as you get older, if you get a brain injury, that area is damaged, you can still access that information through a different route. And this is why you really, well, it's why more years of learning are associated with reduced risk of Alzheimer's disease, and why we really encourage people to keep learning, keep trying new things, novel things, even things that you don't think is going to ever be useful for you. Like, I don't need to learn to knit, but maybe you should try to learn to knit. It's a new skill, it's a new challenge, and it will give your brain a bit of a boost. So always learning and looking for novelty, new challenges, new experiences, new environments, new people is going to help support that cognitive reserve, which is just going to give your brain, and I call it the pension plan for your brain, a little bit more investment in your brain so that if you need it, it's there.
And it's very similar, isn't it, to sort of, I remember when I was a medical student learning about a sort of Hebbian response where these nerve processes, a sort of nerve wave pathways are formed, as you say, by repetition. Mm-hmm. So the more you do it, the stronger the pathway. And about how you, when you learn and you're learning for exams, that the best way to sort of do it is to do like interval training. So you look at it once, go away, do something else, mm-hmm. look at it again, go away, do something else. And that is that building up that pathway so that you remember it. And it's really interesting that probably a lot of that is done in education. And then, as you say, you know, it all sort of feeds into to be protective long term.
Yeah.
And then tell us about the fourth one, or
on the fifth.
It's such a long route to get there, but yeah, it's been fascinating telling us all about it.
Social engagement. So one of the best ways, essentially, stress is your biggest brain risk factor. Too much stress over a too long a period of time can be literally corrosive to your brain. And one of the best ways that we manage our stress, and this is one of the things about our very individualized socialization and community, this idea that we have to manage things by ourselves is absolutely, it's crazy and bizarre and actually goes against what we know about how the body manages stress, is that we each support each other and we each affect each other's stress physiology. So that, and even from miles and miles away, you know, if a member of my family or one of my friends is in Australia, I can say, I'm here for you and I love you and tell me what your problems are. And that will help to bring down their stress. So the quality of your relationships, the amount of social activity and engagement you have is really indicative of your brain health. We know that loneliness is a significant risk factor for things like Alzheimer's and dementia. And that's partly because it's so stressful to be on your own. We're not made to be alone and isolated. So of all the things that we talk about, you know, and all of the things that we prize in our everyday lives, success and achievement, and having a great body and all of this stuff, we miss and we really underplay the importance of investing in your friendships and your relationships for your overall well-being, just feeling happy, but also literally your long-term brain health.
And is that then why reduced hearing leads to social isolation? Is that the mechanism then behind why going deaf or being deaf impacts on brain health and Alzheimer's risk?
Yeah, so they think that it's either or, you know, either or, either because of the reduced socialization that can happen if you lose your hearing and, you know, you just don't go out as much, it's less enjoyable, but also that your brain's getting less challenged. You're hearing fewer things, maybe you're not engaging with music or conversation, so your brain is getting less challenged, and so that use it or lose it principle applies there as well.
Really interesting. Okay, thank you. So we've talked then a lot about all sorts of sort of modifiable risk factors, and it's been, you know, really fascinating. And I just wanted to sort of finish really on this section about stress. I know we've talked quite a lot about stress, but it's really interesting how there's a role between stress and what foods you choose, how that impacts, and also about the sort of the two-directional gut-brain axis. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and so stress has really been the buzzword over the last, I think, 5 or so years, at least in the kind of general conversation, because we're starting to understand, especially with the rise of what's like psychoneuroendocrinology, that this relationship between the brain and the immune system is really starting to be better understood. So stress, small amounts of stress, manageable stress is absolutely fine. And we talk about something called stress inoculation, which is almost like a vaccine in terms of stress. Like if you particularly for children, if you expose them to a small, manageable stress, then they learn how to deal with it and they're more able to cope with a bigger stress later on. So if you allow your kids to maybe fall out with their friends and then to manage it and then give them the tools to go back and then, you know, make things better rather than kind of swooping in and parents taking care of everything, then you give them a little bit of stress inoculation. You teach them how to manage stress. And that happens on a physiological level as well. So small amounts of stress, that's fine. We're not really made to have, you know, to lie down and do nothing all day, live as a completely stress-free life. We need little bits of stress to get stronger. And that's how exercise works, right? When you lift a weight, you stress the muscle and the body responds by becoming a little bit stronger. The next time you can lift a little bit more, a little bit heavier, a little bit longer. The issue comes with chronic unrelenting stress, which doesn't give your body the opportunity to recover. So again, to use the exercise analogy, if you were just hammering it in the gym every day without rest, without proper sleep, then actually you're not going to get the gains. You're not going to get stronger. You're just going to wear yourself out. And that's kind of what happens to the body, this chronic stress. If it doesn't have anywhere to go and your body doesn't have the time to recover, then it can start to wear down the body's own healthy tissues, which is where you kind of get the beginning of autoimmune issues. And
that's all through chronic inflammation. Yeah. So I know that then if you have a big stress, so say, for example, in victims of abuse, that can cause sort of lifelong chronic inflammation, which is, I mean, it's shocking to me to think that that's the case. And is that reversible at all? Can you change that and you modulate it?
It's probably with some difficulty. I think particularly when we're thinking about adverse childhood experiences, so when children who grow up in poverty, children who grow up around violence, children who have, you know, some kind of chronic difficulty, maybe very ill parents or something like that, what happens is that their threshold for stress lowers. So their immune and stress responses become much more quickly triggered and take longer to come down to baseline. So they spend a much longer period in a stressful situation. It's as if their body doesn't develop the safety signal. So they're always in high alert, looking for the danger, which in an evolutionary sense makes sense because, yeah, you know, absolutely, they need to protect themselves and it's about staying safe. But what it can mean as you get older, as you stay in that state, is that, well, it can shift your cognition so that you're always looking for danger. And if you're looking for danger, you will find it. So that becomes a kind of unrelenting cycle. But it can mean that you're always in a state of hypervigilance. When I'm working with somebody who has had that experience, it's really about helping them, A, to understand that process. So this is what happened to you. This is what is likely has occurred in your brain and in your body. And to teach them then that those sorts of people who've had those experiences, are going to need many, many more safety signals for their bodies. They're going to need much more what we would call self-care. So they're really going to have to take care of their sleep. They're really going to have to make sure that they eat very well. They will have to address problems in their relationships early on so that they don't drag out and cause them to feel anxious for a very, very long period of time. You know, so they're going to have to, yeah, you know, they have a vulnerability. And so they're going to have to compensate for that vulnerability with much more self-care and much more interventions that help give their bodies a safety signal.
Wow, it's quite fascinating, really. I mean, I think we're only just now beginning to sort of understand all the sort of long-term effects of these things and how they all work together. And can you just tell us then a little bit about how the gut and the brain are linked? Because I remember as a medical student a long time ago, people sort of saying, oh, back a long time ago, people used to think that emotions were felt in the gut, and that's why we think of sort of butterflies, and we used to think that we felt emotions there. I don't think, you know, for sort of many years people then sort of thought, oh, well, that's a load of rubbish, and actually the gut and the brain aren't connected. But now we have so much of a greater understanding about how they really are connected with nerves and with neurotransmitters. So can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think in two major ways. So one, which I guess many people are much more familiar with at the moment, is the vagus nerve. So this long, I think it's beautiful. Like, I have an anatomical image of it. It's this long wandering nerve that starts in the base of your skull and just essentially goes through all of your major organs and then kind of innervates into in and around the gut. And lots of kind of animal studies at the moment are demonstrating things like gut first Parkinson's, which is that something goes awry in the gut, travels up the vagus nerve, and can trigger Parkinson's, maybe MS, maybe other conditions in the brain. So that there might be this direct way that issues in the gut are triggering autoimmune conditions in the brain. But on your note about emotions, the other thing is about the relationship between affect and emotion. So affect is what we would consider your internal physiological state. So your state of pleasantness or unpleasantness. And it's largely unconscious, you know, that your affect might be affected below your level of consciousness by what your body is digesting or how much sleep you've had. So one of the reasons that we feel a bit grumpy when we haven't had much sleep is that physically your body is struggling. And then what happens is that your brain translates that sense of difficulty or discomfort into emotion of, I don't know, malaise or just feeling a bit meh and a bit, you know, not great. So your affect, your physiological state, your emotions are actually anchored into your body through this relationship between affect. And again, that's why we cannot separate your mental health from your physical health, because your brain is always looking to your affect, to your body, to give an indication of what state you're in. And so you might have a fantastic job and an amazing partner and a great life, but because you're kind of not well fed, not well nourished, your body is struggling, you will struggle to feel good because your affect is informing your brain that things aren't good here. So this is why, again, yeah, we have to move away from this neck up, neck down approach to mental health. We have to, this is why I call it whole body mental health. We have to be bringing it together, because the simplest things, whether you feel good or whether you feel bad, is anchored and rooted in your body.
Absolutely. And even just the sort of on the surface, that when you feel low, you reach for, you know, high nutrient and high fat, high sugar, you know, you reach for a chocolate bar, and then how the chocolate bar impacts your gut health and how your gut health that impacts your brain. I mean, it's quite an amazing circle, really. But no, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you, and a total pleasure. But I really couldn't go without asking you about Bake Off. So first of all, I'm going to ask you, why are you conflicted doing Bake Off? Because obviously, baking is a lot of sugar and a lot of saturated fat, you know, with all that sugar and butter. Do you just indulge, or do you adjust the recipes, or do you choose naturally healthier options? And then do you still bake?
So I wasn't conflicted at all. And that's because I have, I consider myself to be very food positive. And I think if you have a baseline good diet, so if you know, like, my life is fiber. I eat beans all the time. You know, I eat my leafy greens every day. Fruits, you know, I have a good baseline diet. I have oily fish. I also supplement with omega. So I know that my brain is fundamentally nourished. I know that. Yeah. So I know that my system, speaking personally, can tolerate a little bit of sugar, a little bit of butter in a delicious cake. And that there's value in pleasure as well. So I think if you've got a good baseline, then that's not an issue. I think where we need to be, you know, thinking about overall health is actually, can your system tolerate this amount of a processed food or, you know, free sugars? And that's going to be the kind of individual basis of making that decision.
Absolutely. But it's also one of those things that actually you'll never really know. And there's no biomarker to tell you, or you kind of can't really guess that. But I have exactly the same approach to you. I think fundamentally my diet's pretty good. But I will eat cake and I'll really enjoy it, because food is so much more than just nutrients. You know, it is food. It's there socially, it's culturally, enjoyment. And, you know, I love baking. I love a bit of cake. So what's your favourite cake to bake?
My favourite in terms of just being a crowd pleaser is a lemon drizzle. You can't really go wrong with a lemon drizzle. My favourite to eat, actually, is a really good homemade Victoria sponge. Like when people get that right and the sponge is light and buttery and they use good jam, I don't think there is anything better than a slice of Victoria sponge in a cup of tea. So...
And have you got any gossip, any little tidbits from Bake Off that you can share at all to end with?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, our group were kind of rubbish at being competitors. So before the technical challenge, you were all sent out of the tent. And I think, I can't remember who it was actually now, but they like walked by to the tent to see what was being set up, like a little subtle mixie, and then came back to the, well, what we call the green room, but it was just like the living room. I was like, we think it's profiteroles. And then we were all sharing information about what temperature profiteroles should be cooked at. So it was actually a really lovely kind of camaraderie in the tent.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Yeah, I certainly enjoyed watching you. And so it's a really feel-good show, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's, you know, really lovely. But nice to sit down with a cup of tea and a piece of cake and watch it.
Exactly.
But anyway, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And I hope that from speaking to Kimberly, you really know now. So Kimberly's top tips are exercise, aerobic and strength training, eat well. So that's your fiber, fermented foods, your polyphenols, your fruit and vegetables and your whole grains. I'm going to add in whole grains and omega-3. Yeah. And get that sleep where at all possible. And keep doing Sudoku, your mental challenges, learn more, knit, and keep socially active. Yeah. Keep out with your friends and family.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you so much.
It's been such a pleasure. It's been great. Thank you for having me.
I really hope you enjoyed listening, and I'd love if you'd give me a 5-star review and subscribe so that other people can find me too. I'm also at Healthy Eating Doctor on Instagram, and I have lots more nutrition education information on both my video courses and on my website, healthyeatingdoctor.com.